advances in the research and production of wind and solar energy in recent years, it is obviously true that there are currently real limitations to the full utilization of these sustainable technologies. The intermittent nature of solar and wind power requires the development of advanced battery solutions and improved weather forecasting and modeling so the managers of the electrical grid can better plan for when and how much energy will be flowing into the grid from wind and solar. These are hardly insurmountable challenges, and great progress is already being made. There have been significant developments in advanced battery storage technologies that help balance energy supply with demand by capturing energy at times when there is excess on the system for use during hours of high demand. These are happening both on the commercial and homeowner level. For instance, with Tesla's Powerwall units, these types of battery systems will only become more affordable for utilities and families as they become more common and efficient. Likewise, we are making progress on capturing the full capacity of solar and wind power. My state of Vermont was the first in the nation to deploy a statewide smart grid, which is helping utilities more effectively use intermittently available renewable energy sources, as well as respond to outages more quickly. Working with Sandia National Labs, scientists are studying how to better forecast when solar and wind energy will be available, to maximize the integration of these clean energy sources into the grid. They're also testing the viability of a first-in-the-nation neighborhood-scale microgrid, powered entirely by the sun with dedicated backup battery storage. The reality is that the U.S. government has always played a critically important role in funding research and development for almost every major source of energy, from hydro to fossil fuels to nuclear energy. The federal government has spent hundreds of billions of dollars on nuclear power research over decades and still hasn't figured out how to make it safe. The least we can do to ensure our energy supply is clean, reliable, and affordable is to spend a fraction of that amount to help better integrate solar and wind power into the grid and figure out how to affordably store energy when the sun isn't shining and the wind isn't blowing. Climate justice. It is important to acknowledge that while the impacts of climate change will touch us all, its impacts will not be felt equally. As is so often the case, disenfranchised, minority, and poor communities will undoubtedly be hardest hit. Just take a look at the disproportionate impact of Hurricane Katrina on poor and African-American neighborhoods in New Orleans. Do you really think a wealthier neighborhood would have had such substandard levees? Not likely. Which is why, as we develop plans to address climate resiliency, we must recognize the heightened public health risks faced by low-income and minority communities. Of course, this is not a problem unique to the United States. In November 2015, the World Bank issued a report highlighting how the effects of global warming are being disproportionately borne by poor communities around the world, and that trend will only worsen because these communities are least prepared to deal with such climate shocks, as rising seas, extreme weather, or severe droughts. The report estimated that as many as 100 million people could be pushed into extreme poverty by 2030 because of disrupted agriculture and the spread of malaria and other diseases. This is why funding resiliency efforts in poor communities and mitigating the disproportionate impacts of climate change on the most vulnerable must be a part of any international climate negotiations. We must also make sure that poor and minority communities share in the benefits of the clean energy revolution. From access to new green jobs to energy efficiency and renewable energy efforts, we have to make sure no one is left behind. That is why in 2015, I introduced legislation to make solar energy more accessible to low-income families. While the cost of solar panels has gone down significantly, it is still out of reach for millions of low-income families that need it the most, families that struggle to pay electricity bills. This effort would also help build arrays on community facilities and public housing, and target set asides for projects in Appalachia, Native American tribal areas, and Alaskan Native communities. Leading at home and abroad. Climate change is truly a global problem. The decisions individual countries, especially the advanced industrialized countries, make about their energy systems affect everyone else on this planet. The carbon dioxide released into the atmosphere in the United States, China, or Spain has no nationality and respects no borders, nor does the heat wave, hurricane, or drought caused by global warming. Moreover, even if the U.S. were to successfully transform its energy system to 100% renewables, it would not likely be enough to avoid the worst consequences of climate change. The fact of the matter is, we're all in the same boat together, and solving this unprecedented global challenge will require an unprecedented level of international cooperation. As the most powerful country in the history of the planet, the United States must help lead that effort. The December 2015 Paris Climate Conference, COP21, was an important step in that direction. In fact, for the first time, 195 countries adopted a universal, legally binding global climate deal. I applaud President Obama for his unwavering leadership in Paris and for standing up to the powerful interests in this country who opposed his efforts. However, while the agreement sets out a global action plan to limit global warming, many climate scientists believe the accord goes nowhere near far enough in terms of reducing global carbon emissions. The good news is, there's a framework in place. Our goal now must be to strengthen the accord by setting more aggressive carbon reduction goals. We cannot leave it up to our government to carry the water for us. We all know that the fossil fuel industry has enormous power and enormous influence over governmental decisions throughout the world. What has to happen is that the United States must lead an international mobilization on a scale not seen since World War II to address this planetary environmental crisis. If we could save our way of life by leading an international coalition in that massive and terrible war, we must now endeavor to save the planet through a similar effort. Furthermore, while we cannot solve this problem alone, the United States can and should lead by example. Our country has contributed greatly to climate change, but we also have the largest stage and the greatest know-how to lead in implementing climate change solutions. Part of our challenge should be to show that the transition to a clean energy future can work, that we can produce affordable clean energy and strengthen our economy. Right now, the template developing countries have for industrialization is based on burning fossil fuels. We are uniquely positioned with the largest economy in the world to demonstrate there's a viable alternative. Unless we take bold action to reverse climate change, our children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren are going to look back on this period of history and ask a very simple question. Where were they? Why didn't the United States of America, the most powerful nation on Earth, lead the international community in cutting greenhouse gas emissions and preventing the devastating damage that the scientific community was so sure would come? 7. Real criminal justice reform. In the United States today, we have more people in jail than in any other country on earth. We are spending $80 billion a year to lock up 2.2 million Americans, disproportionately African American, Latino, and Native American. To my mind, it makes a lot more sense to invest in education and jobs than in jails and in incarceration. It's time for real criminal justice reform. If my campaign for president stood for anything, it was about all of us standing together as one nation to demand a better life for all. Black, white, Latino, Asian American, and Native American, standing together and not allowing demagogues to scapegoat minorities and divide us up, standing together to create the kind of America we know we can become. If we are to be successful in that goal, we must confront one of the most contentious and intractable issues facing our country, the same issue I protested in Chicago 50 years ago, the ugly stain of racism. The sad reality is that racism has plagued the United States since before its founding. The atrocities committed against the Native Americans, who inhabited this land long before Europeans arrived, are beyond appalling, as is the abomination of slavery perpetrated against Africans and their descendants brought to this continent to labor and servitude. Racism has impacted people who immigrated to this country from Latin America and Asia. It has impacted the Irish, the Italians, and the Jews. Racism has afflicted our nation for centuries, and it continues to afflict our nation today. Ironically, after Barack Obama became the first African-American president, some people triumphantly declared an end to racism, that we had finally moved beyond the color line. Unfortunately, they were completely wrong. In fact, the past 8 years have shown just how open the wounds of racism remain in our country and the many ways they manifest. This was brought to light even more during the presidential campaign, thanks to a major party candidate who, instead of bringing the American people together, seemed intent on doing everything possible to divide us up. Donald Trump threatened to deport 11 million Latinos, restrict immigration based on religion, and create a national database of Muslim citizens. And his relationship to the African American community featured his role as one of the leaders of the birther movement, a disgusting effort to undermine the legitimacy of our first African-American president by suggesting that he was not born in the United States. There is no question that in recent decades, we have made significant progress in creating a country where we judge people, as Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. urged, not by the color of their skin, not by the language they speak, not by the country they came from, but by the content of their character and their qualities as human beings. Make no mistake about it. While we have come a long way, there's still a long distance to go before we fulfill Dr. King's dream. Police Department Reform. Among many other struggles we must engage in to combat racism in this country, we must stop police brutality and the killing of unarmed African Americans. This has emerged as one of the great civil rights issues of the early 21st century. The names and the incidents are all too familiar to us, innocent people who should be alive today, but who died while being arrested or in the custody of the police. Sandra Bland, Michael Brown, Rakia Boyd, Eric Garner, Walter Scott, Freddie Gray, Jessica Hernandez, Tamir Rice, Jonathan Farrell, Philando Castile, Elton Sterling, Oscar Grant, Antonio Zambrano Montes, Laquan McDonald, Samuel DeBose, and Anastasio Hernandez Rojas, and many others. We know their names. Each of them died unarmed at the hands of police officers or in police custody. Eric Garner was choked to death in New York City because he was selling single cigarettes. Alton Sterling was shot while pinned on the ground by Baton Rouge police, who were called because Sterling was selling CDs outside a store. Freddie Gray died of a spinal cord injury while in Baltimore police custody. 12-year-old Tamir Rice was killed by Cleveland police officers within 2 seconds of their arrival on the scene. Sandra Bland, who was pulled from her car, thrown to the ground, and handcuffed. 3 days later, she was found dead in her Texas jail cell. Samuel DeBose was fatally shot in Cincinnati during a traffic stop for a missing license plate. Philando Castile was killed by police in Minneapolis during a traffic stop for a busted taillight. Walter Scott was pulled over for a broken brake light in South Carolina and was shot in the back by an officer. And on it goes. Across the nation, too many African Americans and other minorities find themselves subjected to a system that treats citizens who have not committed crimes like criminals. Because of over-policing in minority communities and racial profiling, African Americans are twice as likely to be arrested and almost four times as likely to experience the use of force during encounters with the police than whites. Although there's no national database of police shootings, one group that tracks these cases says that in 2015, police officers killed at least 102 unarmed black people, five times the rate at which they killed unarmed whites. Violence and brutality of any kind at the hands of the police is unacceptable and must not be tolerated. It is no wonder that a growing number of communities of color do not trust the police, and why the influence of the Black Lives Matter movement is growing. I was a mayor for 8 years, and in that capacity worked closely with my police department and police officers throughout Vermont. As a congressman and senator, I have worked with law enforcement officials throughout the country. And here's the truth. Being a police officer is an extremely difficult and stressful job. Many officers are underpaid and undertrained and have irregular schedules that negatively impact their family lives. The vast majority of those who serve in law enforcement are decent, hard-working people who are motivated to make their communities better places to live, and many have sacrificed much to do their jobs. To my mind, that is all the more reason we must stand up and denounce acts of illegal behavior when they are perpetrated by the police. Police officers must be held accountable. In a society based on law, nobody can be above the law, especially those who are charged with enforcing the law. We must end the war on drugs. Of course, the intersection of racism and criminal justice is not limited to police violence. To my mind, an even bigger issue is the failed war on drugs, which has over the decades harmed millions of lives through the arrest and jailing of people for nonviolent crimes. The number of incarcerated drug offenders has increased 12-fold since 1980, and this war has disproportionately targeted people of color. According to the Substance Abuse of Mental Health Services Administration, blacks and whites use drugs at roughly the same overall rates. However, blacks are arrested for drug use at far greater rates than whites, largely because of over-policing, racial profiling, and, according to the Department of Justice, the fact that blacks are three times more likely to be searched during a traffic stop compared with white motorists. Take marijuana use. How many encounters between young people and the police begin with officers detecting the odor of marijuana? According to the best research, blacks smoke marijuana at a slightly higher rate than whites. According to the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, however, they are four times more likely to be arrested for marijuana possession. Think about it. Does anybody doubt for a second that an upper-middle-class white kid in Greenwich, Connecticut, has a much lower chance of being arrested for smoking marijuana than a lower-income black kid in Chicago or Baltimore? And marijuana is inexplicably a Schedule I drug, the designation reserved for highly dangerous and addictive drugs such as heroin, under the Federal Controlled Substance Act. Now, people can argue about the pros and cons of legalizing marijuana, just as we can argue about the merits of the legality of tobacco, which causes cancer and other terrible diseases. But no sane person can think that marijuana is equivalent to heroin, a killer drug, in terms of its health impact. That's absurd. But that's the way it's treated. To fully grasp how this impacts our criminal justice system, consider that in 2014, there were 620,000 total marijuana possession arrests. That's more than one every minute. There were more than 7 million marijuana possession arrests in the U.S. from 2001 to 2010, and that's a major reason why African Americans account for 37% of those arrested for drug offenses when they only comprise 14% of regular drug users. Overall, blacks are imprisoned at 7 times the rate of whites. In fact, according to the most recent statistics, 1 of every 15 African-American men is incarcerated, compared with 1 in every 106 white men. If current trends continue, 1 in 4 black males born today can expect to spend time in prison during his lifetime. This is an outrage. This is the destruction of a generation. This must change. Sadly, the situation is not that much better for African American women, who are 3 times more likely than white women to be incarcerated. Moreover, African Americans face more serious consequences when sentenced. Even when convicted for the exact same crimes, black offenders receive sentences that were an average 10% longer than those received by white offenders. And for decades, racially biased mandatory minimums have unfairly punished people of color. For instance, for years, powdered cocaine, used more frequently by whites than blacks, required 100 times the weight to trigger the same mandatory penalty as crack cocaine, used almost 3 times more frequently by blacks. These statistics, needless to say, raise serious doubts about equal treatment under the law. Just look at the outcomes. African Americans and Latinos together comprised 57% of all prisoners in 2014, even though neither of these two groups make up even 1/4 of the U.S. population. Meanwhile, African American youth alone make up 2/5 of all confined youth today. Further, what has to be understood is that, according to the Bureau of Justice Statistics, just 6% of African Americans' arrests in 2014 were for violent crimes, and another 14% were for property crimes. What is driving the incarceration of blacks is nonviolent drug-related crimes. In fact, according to the Federal Bureau of Prisons, 50% of all federal prisoners are locked up for nonviolent drug offenses. This is expensive. It is a waste of human potential. It is, in a word, stupid. We must end the over-incarceration of non-violent young Americans who do not pose a serious threat to our society. By the way, if anyone thinks that a criminal record regarding a marijuana arrest is some small matter, think again. There are a lot of people out there who apply for jobs and don't get them because of that record. And if you don't get a job and you don't have any income, bad things happen. Further, we have been putting far too little emphasis on prevention, like good education, after-school programming, and meaningful job opportunities that give young people healthy alternatives to drifting into a life of drug use. I've been to urban communities that have major drug addiction issues. Meanwhile, their after-school and mentoring programs have been shut down for lack of funds. That's brilliant. Leave kids on the streets with nothing to do and then become shocked and appalled when they become involved with drugs. My Republican colleagues are proud that they have saved taxpayer money by eliminating funding for summer jobs programs. Really? Do they not understand that a kid who earns a paycheck and learns a skill is far less likely to end up in jail at far greater cost to the taxpayer? Dealing with mental health. In addition, the time is long overdue for this country to understand that we cannot jail our way out of health problems like mental illness and drug addiction. Our country is facing an opioid crisis, both in terms of prescription pain medicine abuse and heroin addiction. People are dying every day from overdoses. But the solution is not to lock up addicts. We have to treat substance abuse as a serious public health issue rather than a criminal issue so that all people, regardless of their income, can get the help they need. In addition, in terms of treating addiction, we put far too little emphasis on coordinated treatment and support programs that combine medication-assisted therapies such as methadone and buprenorphine with counseling and behavioral therapies. We must also understand that we have a mental health crisis in this country and that many mentally ill people are ending up in jail because there's no place else for them to go. Over the last several decades, we have made a bad situation even worse by cutting back on the programs and support systems that mentally ill people need in order to survive and improve. Once again, we are being penny-wise and pound-foolish. We save money by cutting back on housing and treatment for the mentally ill, and we spend far, far more by having vulnerable people end up in jail. Of the 44 million adults with a mental illness, fewer than half received the mental health services they needed in the past year. Instead of making mental health services more affordable and accessible for all Americans, we dump people in jail where they get little or no treatment at far greater cost. The end result of the war on drugs and our failure to treat mental illness in a rational way is that the United States of America has more people in jails and prisons than in any other country on earth. We have less than 5% of the world's population, yet we have a quarter of all prisoners. We now have more people in jails and prisons than does the communist totalitarian state of China, which has a population 4 times our own. It is a national tragedy that the number of incarcerated Americans has more than quadrupled since Ronald Reagan first ran on a Get Tough on Crime platform, from about 500,000 in 1980 to more than 2.2 million today, and we spend $80 billion a year in federal, state, and local taxpayer dollars to lock them up. $80 billion a year. I can think of an awful lot of real needs that can be met with $80 billion a year. Ending private prisons. Private corporations should not be making profits off the incarceration of human beings. But that is exactly what is happening today in our country, big time. According to the ACLU, as part of the movement toward privatization that we are seeing in sector after sector, the number of adult prisoners housed in private prisons has jumped almost 1,600% since 1990. Last year, there were about 130,000 federal and state prisoners in private facilities. According to a February 2016 report by In the Public Interest, the two largest prison operators in the United States made a combined $361 million housing them. The Corrections Corporation of America, the nation's largest private prison operator, collected $3,356 a year in profit for each prisoner, while GEO Group, the country's second largest, made $2,135 a year in profit per prisoner. That is unacceptable. Study after study has shown that private prisons are not cheaper, they're not safer, and they do not provide better outcomes for either the prisoners or the state. What they do provide is an incentive to keep prison beds full. They interfere with the administration of justice. No one, in my view, should be allowed to profit from putting more people behind bars. The private prison racket extends to the Department of Homeland Security, too. More than 60% of all immigration detention beds are in prisons operated by for-profit prison corporations. These include two of the country's three family detention centers that house unaccompanied minors and mothers with babies, where there have been reports of inadequate food and medical treatment, sexual abuse, and other serious human rights abuses. In September 2015, I introduced the Justice Is Not For Sale Act to bar the federal government from contracting with private prison companies. I also made abolishing private prisons a plank in my presidential campaign. I was very pleased, therefore, when in August 2016, the Department of Justice said it would phase out the use of private prisons. Just 2 weeks later, the Department of Homeland Security announced it might follow suit. We have got to end the private prison racket in America as quickly as possible. Our focus should be on keeping people out of jail and making sure they stay out when they are released. Ending the death penalty. Let me say one last thing about fixing our broken criminal justice system. It is long past time for the United States of America to join almost every other advanced country on earth in abolishing the death penalty. The death penalty is cruel and unusual punishment. It is applied disproportionately to people of color. It has been proven to not deter violent crime. The inevitable endless judicial appeals tie up the courts for years at the taxpayers' expense. And far too many people are now thought, after they were put to death by the state, to have been innocent. We are all shocked and disgusted by some of the horrific murders that we see in this country. When people commit horrendous crimes, we should lock them up and throw away the key. But the state, in a democratic and civilized society, should not itself be involved in murder. Frankly, we should not be in the company of China, the world's leader in the use of the death penalty, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Iraq, Sudan, Yemen, Egypt, and Somalia. Rather, we should be in the company of virtually every other major democratic society that understands that even when confronted with unspeakable violence, we must move beyond ancient concepts of revenge. We must recognize, as Mohandas Gandhi did, that in the end, an eye for an eye simply makes everybody blind. The impacts of institutional and structural racism. Just weeks before his death, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. spoke to a union group in New York about what he called the other America. He said, "One America is flowing with the milk of prosperity and the honey of equality. That America is the habitat of millions of people who have food and material necessities for their bodies, culture, and education for their minds. Freedom and human dignity for their spirits. But as we assemble here tonight, I'm sure that each of us is painfully aware of the fact that there is another America, and that other America has a daily ugliness about it that transforms the buoyancy of hope into the fatigue of despair." The problem was structural, King said. This country has socialism for the rich, rugged individualism for the poor. What he saw in 1968, and what we all should recognize today, is that we must simultaneously address the structural and institutional racism that exists in this country while creating an economy that works for all and not just for the people on top. This is especially true in minority communities where poverty, unemployment, and inadequate schools are rampant. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, African American median household income in 2014 was $35,398 compared with the $60,256 for non-Hispanic white households. While African Americans account for 12.2% of our nation's population, they make up just 5.7% of income earners in the top quintile, the top 20% of all households. On the other end of the spectrum, African Americans are heavily overrepresented in the lowest quintile of earners. In fact, more than 26% of African Americans were living at or below the poverty level in comparison with about 10% of non-Hispanic whites. Most Black and Latino households have less than $350 in savings. According to the Pew Research Center, the average African American household has a total net worth, the value of all assets minus debts, of just $11,000. Meanwhile, the average white family has a net worth of $141,900. And to make things even worse, when Wall Street nearly drove the economy off a cliff, minority households and communities were hardest hit. Even in good times, the black unemployment rate has remained almost twice as high as the white rate over the last 40 years. But during the Great Recession, African Americans lost jobs at twice the rate of white workers. And in pockets of the country, it was even worse. According to the Economic Policy Institute, the black unemployment rate in Miami went from 6.7% before the recession to 17.2% in 2010. In Greater Los Angeles, it rose from 8.6% to 19.3%. In Las Vegas, it soared from 8.2% to 20.1%. And in Detroit, black unemployment reached Depression-era levels of 25.7%. Real African-American youth unemployment broke 50%. Even in April 2011, more than 3 years after the recession began and in the midst of what was supposed to be the recovery, the official black unemployment rate stood at 16.1%, twice the official white unemployment rate of 8.0%. And the jobs weren't just slower to come back, many never came back at all. And that's been going on for a while. Against that backdrop of rising unemployment and declining wages, black and Latino households were disproportionately steered into expensive subprime mortgages for years leading up to the housing crash. African Americans were three times more likely to receive a subprime loan than whites, and many of those loans were designed to fail. Which is why, when the housing bubble burst, minority households were 70% more likely to lose their homes to foreclosure than white households. And because African Americans and Latinos tended to have most of their wealth tied up in their homes, total net worth fell by more than 50% for African American households and by more than 65% for Latino families. Can you imagine what that does to families that have spent their entire lives working hard, struggling to get ahead? Can you imagine what that does to entire neighborhoods like Freddie Gray's, West Baltimore, where the poverty rate now exceeds 35%, where less than half of the residents have jobs, where more than a third of the homes are vacant or abandoned, and where less than 5% of the population has a college degree? In this country, we treat our children shamefully. We have the highest rate of childhood poverty of almost any other major country on earth, and we maintain a dysfunctional child care system. But as bad as the situation is for our kids and our country as a whole, it is far worse in minority communities. Black children, who make up just 18% of preschoolers, account for 48% of all out-of-school suspensions before kindergarten. We are failing our black children before they even start kindergarten. Even though we know that 90% of brain development occurs between birth and 5 years of age, we allow early children education in minority communities to remain a total disgrace. Black elementary and high school students are more than three times as likely as whites to attend schools where fewer than 60% of the teachers meet all state certification and licensure requirements. They are more likely to attend schools with higher concentrations of first-year teachers. They are expelled at three times the rate of white students. According to the Department of Education, African American students are more likely to suffer harsh punishments, suspensions, and arrests at school. African American kids are five times more likely than white children to have lead poisoning, and one in six has asthma. Indigenous peoples are disproportionately impacted by destructive mining practices and the dumping of hazardous materials on their lands. Low-income Latinos are more likely to live in areas with high levels of hazardous air pollution than anyone else. There is a pipeline from school to jail that we have to turn into a pipeline from school to a promising future. If current trends continue, an estimated 69% of African American men who drop out of high school will end up in jail. We have to make certain they do not. Reforming a broken criminal justice system. We must come together with a sense of shared purpose and demand policies to transform this country into a nation that affirms the value of all our people, regardless of race, income, or national origin. We need a criminal justice system that not only protects our people from crime, but is based on justice for all, non-discriminatory policies, and the understanding that the prevention of crime is a much worthier approach than punishment. We must re-examine honestly how we police America, and the federal government can play an important role in establishing a new model police training program that reorients us in the way we do law enforcement. First and foremost, we must develop new rules on the allowable use of force. Police officers need to be trained to de-escalate confrontations and to humanely interact with people, especially people who have mental illnesses. Lethal force should be the last response, not the first. Every effort should be made to have police forces reflect the diversity of the communities they work in, and that must include positions of leadership and in training departments. We must demand greater civilian oversight of police departments and ongoing and meaningful community engagement. We must demilitarize our police forces so that they don't look and act like invading armies. Police departments must be part of the community they serve and trusted by the community. Too often, we see local police forces with military-style vehicles and weapons that make them look like occupying armies trying to conquer some faraway country. We should federally fund and require body cameras for law enforcement officers to make it easier to hold everyone accountable for their actions while establishing standards to protect the privacy of innocent people. We must ensure that police departments do not shield bad actors from accountability and that they instead show zero tolerance for abuses of police power. All employees deserve due process protections, but departments must vigorously investigate and, if necessary, prosecute allegations of wrongdoing, especially those involving the use of force. Every death that occurs during an arrest or while someone is in police custody should be investigated by the U.S. Department of Justice. We must stop cash-starved communities from using their police forces as revenue generators. In many cities, the incentives for policing are upside down. Police departments are bringing in substantial revenue by ticketing poor people for minor offenses and by seizing the personal property of people who are suspect of criminal involvement. When policing becomes a source of revenue, officers are often pressured to meet goals that can lead to unnecessary or unlawful traffic stops and citations. And civil asset forfeiture laws allow police to take property from people even before they are charged with a crime. Even worse, it is often difficult and expensive for an innocent person to get his or her property back. We must end these practices. The time is long overdue for us to take marijuana off the federal government's list of outlawed drugs under the Controlled Substances Act. 4 states and the District of Columbia have already legalized the personal use of marijuana, and the federal government shouldn't stand in the way of other states deciding to regulate it, the same way they do alcohol and tobacco. That means, too, that businesses in states that have legalized marijuana should be fully able to use the banking system without fear of federal prosecution. We must invest in drug courts and interventions so that people end up in treatment rather than prison. We must end mandatory minimal sentencing and give judges the discretion to better tailor sentences to the specific facts of a given case. The federal system of parole needs to be reinstated because people who are serving long sentences need incentives to make productive choices and earn their way to shorter sentences. We must make it easier, not harder, for people who have served sentences to reintegrate into society. They need a path back from prison that will allow them to lead productive lives rather than returning to a life of crime and to jail. I recall a town meeting I had in Iowa on criminal justice where one of our speakers, a former inmate, recounted that he learned he was being released one day before he was let out. On the next day, he was given a check for $75 and sent on his way. That was it. We can and must do better than that. People who leave jail need jobs, housing, education, and a real chance to make it in civil society. Giving former inmates a real chance means banning the box, to prohibit employers from discriminating against job applicants because of a prior conviction. Individuals re-entering the workforce should be able to apply for work based on their current merits rather than on past wrongdoings. And once someone gets out of jail, their full voting rights should be restored. As many as 6 million Americans, largely poor and minority, who have served their time in jail were not able to vote in the 2016 election. This has nothing to do with criminal justice. It is a partisan political decision. When people do their time, their rights as citizens in a democratic society should be reinstated. 8. Immigration reform now. Our immigration system is broken. We need comprehensive immigration reform that provides a pathway to citizenship for undocumented immigrants living in the shadows, keeps families together, and promotes civil and labor rights for all. I'm proud to be the son of an immigrant. My father came to this country from Poland at the age of 17 without a nickel in his pocket. Several years ago, my brother Larry and I visited the tiny town where he was born and raised. While we were there, I was struck by the unbelievable courage of that young man who, with no money, little education, and not knowing one word of English, traveled across the ocean in 1921 in search of a better life. His history, my story, our story, is a story of America. Hard-working people and families coming to the United States to create a brighter future for themselves and their children. It is a story rooted in family and fueled by hope. There is a reason the Statue of Liberty is one of our most iconic images. Since the nation's founding, untold numbers of people have come to our shores to improve their lives, escape oppression or violence, or flee desperate poverty. More than any other country in the history of the modern world, the United States has been shaped in its identity and character by the process of immigration and the contributions of those immigrants. But at the same time, the history of immigration in our country has often been difficult and contentious. To suggest otherwise is to forget about some of the great struggles of our past. In the 1850s, the once dominant Whig Party was splintered by the virulently anti-immigrant Know-Nothing movement. Whipped up by nativist politicians feigning fear of foreigners and blaming immigrants for all sorts of domestic problems, Know-Nothing Party rallies routinely devolved into shouting and even violence. For more than a year, I traveled throughout the country and talked to immigrant families, particularly Latino families. And I was deeply moved by their stories of struggle, their victories and defeats, and their extraordinary aspirations. I was also moved by the fear and the sadness that gripped so many of them because of the increasingly dark tenor of today's immigration debate. This mood existed, of course, largely because Donald Trump engaged in a level of unabashed xenophobia and immigrant bashing not seen in our country for a very long time. It is hard to believe that in the year 2016, we had a major party candidate for president who made bigotry the cornerstone of his campaign. But an unintended consequence of his vitriol is that immigration reform has been brought into the spotlight where it belongs. After all, Trump is correct in saying that our immigration system is broken. He's just dead wrong about both the causes and the solutions. Today, there are more than 11 million undocumented immigrants in this country living in the shadows. More than 85% have resided in the United States for at least 5 years, and many have been here for decades. The vast majority are law-abiding, they have come from many countries, and for many reasons. undocumented immigrants are woven into the fabric of our society and our economy. They work in some of the hardest and lowest paid jobs. Without undocumented workers, it is likely that the agricultural system in the United States would collapse, with rapidly rising food prices and limitations on a variety of food we consume. The undocumented are also integral parts of the communities in which they live, as they volunteer at local libraries, serve on school PTAs, and coach their kids on baseball and soccer teams. Today, these families are forced to live in fear that their immigration status will be found out. The threat of deportation is never far from their minds, and I will never forget hearing their stories while on the campaign trail. In Phoenix, Arizona, a group of high school students, some with tears running down their cheeks, recounted how they worry that when they get home from school, they might find out that their mom or dad was arrested and about to be deported. Never mind that the students were all born here and are American citizens, their parents are not. These kids live every day knowing that their families could be torn apart. No child, no teenager, no adult should have to go through that. Yet today in America, millions do. I talked to a young man serving in the United States military, and he told me that while he was deployed on active duty, his wife was deported. That is one hell of a way to thank someone willing to die defending his country, our country. I talked to a 12-year-old boy born in Arizona who is being raised on this side of the Mexican border after his mother was deported. He told me about being torn between going to live with his mother in Mexico or staying here in the only country he has ever known. The vast majority of undocumented immigrants have come to the United States to work and improve their stations in life. They are highly motivated to be productive members of society, and the reality is they contribute significantly to our economy. According to Pew's Hispanic Trends Project, an estimated 8.4 million unauthorized immigrant workers in the U.S., about 5.2% of the entire labor force, collectively, they pay an estimated $11.6 billion each year in state and local taxes, according to the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, ITEP. This includes state and local income taxes, property taxes on homes they own or rent, gas taxes at the pumps, and sales and excise taxes on goods they buy. Moreover, ITEP estimates they pay an average of 8% of their incomes in state and local taxes, which, by the way, is 48% higher than the 5.4% paid by the top 1% of taxpayers. If all undocumented immigrants in the country today were granted legal status, their state and local tax contributions would increase by $2.1 billion a year. About half of undocumented workers also pay federal income taxes, but since their work is often under the table and off the books, they can't collect on their end of the social contract. It is estimated that these undocumented workers have contributed close to $300 billion to the Social Security Trust Fund for benefits they will not receive. And that doesn't include federal income or payroll taxes. Meanwhile, undocumented workers are not protected by many of the labor laws and regulations that cover other workers. If undocumented workers experience unsafe working conditions, they often will not speak up for fear of being fired or exposed to the authorities. If they are harassed on the job, they have no recourse. If they are forced to work unreasonably long hours or cheated out of pay, they have nowhere to turn. And for the most part, they can forget about forming a union to press for better conditions. Now, who do you think really benefits most from illegal immigration? A University of California economics professor, Gordon Hanson, noted, "The benefits go primarily to one group of individuals, and that is employers in industries that hire illegal immigrants intensively, construction, agriculture, hospitality, and tourism." The reality is that many businesses, large and small, have long used undocumented workers to pad their bottom lines. Just consider the agricultural workforce. In California alone, where the $45 billion a year agricultural sector supplies more than half the produce consumed in the United States, between 40 and 50% of the workforce is made up of undocumented workers. No wonder California has been the site of some of the most important immigrant labor struggles brought to the consciousness of many Americans in the 1960s and 1970s by the great United Farm Workers leader, Cesar Chavez. That struggle continues today. In May, I met with a group of Latino leaders in Bakersfield, including David Valerino Gonzalez, Cesar Chavez's son-in-law, to discuss the plight of farm workers in the San Joaquin Valley. The next day, I visited 40 acres in Delano, where Chavez organized for better labor conditions in the 1960s. I was honored to be led on the tour by Federico Chavez, a nephew of the late organizer and an active volunteer for my campaign. We discussed the fact that all too often, farm workers are still paid horrendously low wages, exposed to pesticides, and deprived of the most basic decent living conditions. Many of their homes lack clean drinking water, just as when Cesar Chavez led the UFW. Today's struggle is aimed at providing decent wages and working conditions for farm workers, and demanding that the corporations that own the farms treat their employees with dignity. Of course, this issue isn't limited to just California. In 2008, I traveled to southern Florida to meet with the Coalition of Imokale Workers, the CIW, which does heroic work standing up for migrant workers who are paid starvation wages for back-breaking work. Most of these farm workers grow and harvest tomatoes that are bought by fast food giants and supermarket chains. The working and living conditions in Imokale were unimaginable. In fact, several labor contractors there had been prosecuted for holding farm workers against their will. In other words, they were engaged in involuntary slavery, chaining workers inside U-Haul trucks at night and beating them during the day. I invited some CIW leaders to testify at a Senate hearing on abusive labor practices, which helped bring increased scrutiny to the issue. Because of the tremendous grassroots effort of CIW, supported by Oxfam America and dozens of other organizations, working conditions of the Imokale began to improve and workers received a small wage increase when Burger King, Subway, Taco Bell, Whole Foods, and many others agreed to pay higher prices for the tomatoes. But that struggle also continues with CIW launching a national boycott of Wendy's earlier this year. Moreover, how many more Imokales are out there? How many thousands of undocumented workers are being ruthlessly exploited every day, with few people knowing about it? Exploitation of undocumented workers is certainly not limited to the agriculture sector. A 2013 report by NPR's Marketplace exposed how the Chicago doll manufacturing company, Tye, used several layers of shadowy labor brokers to find undocumented workers for its factories. Since the workers weren't direct employees of the company, Tye had plausible deniability about their immigration status. These workers labored long hours at the minimum wage, and then had to pay the brokers out of their own pockets for the privilege of being selected to work that day or week. And sometimes they weren't paid at all. Of course, they had no legal recourse, no one to complain to. Marketplace found similar practices at Fresh Express, Sony, Frito-Lay, and Smirnoff. Walmart has employed undocumented workers to clean their stores. Tyson Foods has used them to process chickens, amid many violations of laws on workplace conditions and allegations of human smuggling. Many American families, including at least two nominees for attorney general, have employed undocumented workers to care for their children. Undocumented workers cut lawns, clean hotel rooms, work in oil fields, and staff nursing homes. In my state of Vermont, they work on a growing number of dairy farms. They work on construction crews, and many helped rebuild entire neighborhoods in New Orleans after Katrina. If we are serious about increasing wages in this country for all workers, immigrant and native-born alike, we must extend labor protections to undocumented workers and stop allowing employers to pay them starvation wages. If we start giving undocumented workers legal protections, we can slow down the race to the bottom. Wages for the lowest paid workers in the country will rise again, and with legal status, they will be able to join unions and negotiate decent pay and working conditions. A rising tide lifts all boats. But that would impact big businesses' bottom line. And therein lies the rub. After all, the political and business establishment in this country is really not all that concerned about immigration's impact on native-born, low-skill workers. But they are very concerned about profit margins. Let me give you an example. During the campaign, I was criticized by Secretary Clinton for opposing a 2007 immigration bill. The truth is, while I supported much of the bill, I could not bring myself to vote for it because it included temporary guest worker programs. I was not alone in opposition. The bill was also opposed by other progressive members of Congress, by the AFL-CIO, and by the League of United Latin American Citizens, LULAC, the nation's largest and oldest Hispanic organization. Over the years, corporate America has successfully pushed for the creation of federal programs that allow employers to bring temporary guest workers into the country, supposedly because there's no one here who can do the jobs. Of course, that threshold is very squishy and has been